This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Are we or are we not? That, honestly, is not the question. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today, the 28th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The question in question, of course, is, are we or are we not in a recession? And we'll get to that in a second. But just because a story like gross domestic product, which, as you have almost surely heard already, shrank 0.9% in the second quarter on an annualized basis, just because GDP is complicated, we are going to start with the mechanics of the news and then get to the feelings about the news. A shrinking economy is not great, and 6 months in a row of a shrinking economy is very not great. But if you look at the beating heart of this economy, us, consumers, we are still spending, and therein lies, perhaps, a glimmer of hope. Marketplace's Sabri Benishor gets us going.
On the one hand, we cut back on buying cars, held off spending on furniture, too, even takeout and groceries. All told, we cut back on buying things by more than 4%.
A lot of the things that I have seen, a lot of supply chain issues, people are kind of rotating out of that as those prices are elevated.
Justin Widener is an economist at Deutsche Bank. Now, did we cut back on goods because we were saving, putting that money away for a rainy day? Not at all. We were just spending on other things. Healthcare, trips, going out to bars, catching up on all the things that we didn't do at the start of the pandemic.
You're starting to see this normalization in terms of people's spending habits, shifting back from goods back into services.
So when you net it all out and take into account inflation, we, the consumer, actually spent about 1% more on everything total in the second quarter. That is growth. Andrew Hunter is a senior U.S. economist at Capital Economics.
One positive point to make from the Q2 report is that, yes, consumption growth slowed, but it still increased, whereas obviously overall GDP fell.
In fact, the main reason why GDP didn't technically grow in the second quarter is because a bunch of companies made a big oopsie-daisy and bought too many goods that we didn't want, so they had to hold off on buying more while their warehouses cleared out. That showed up in the data. Ben Herzon is a senior U.S. economist at S&P Global Market Intelligence.
So in the second quarter, the slowing in the pace of inventory investment subtracted 2 percentage points from GDP growth. So had it not been for that, GDP would have rose.
Herzon predicts GDP will actually grow 0.9% in the third quarter. But the consumer may not be able to keep saving the day indefinitely. Yeah, we're spending more on services, but guess what? They're getting more expensive. Again, Justin Widener at Deutsche Bank.
In June, year-over-year services inflation was 5.5%. We had that rising up to about 7% by the end of the year.
Rents are still rising, eating away at income. Personal disposable income fell 0.5% in the second quarter. Investment in homes fell sharply. The Fed is still raising rates. We consumers might be the engine of the U.S. economy, but there is a lot out there to slow us down. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
All right, so let's roll with the subtext of Sabri's last bit there, the whole things that could slow us down thing, and how important how people are feeling about this economy is. To do that, we've gotten Wendy Edelberg on the phone. She is the director of the Hamilton Project, also a senior fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institution. Wendy, welcome back. It's good to have you back.
I'm happy to be back, too.
So, I don't know if you watched Treasury Secretary Yellen's press conference today. You probably did, right?
I have read reports of it. Right, okay. I didn't actually watch the whole thing.
She said in almost as many words, listen, I don't want to get bogged down in the semantics of this thing of whether we are or are not in a recession, because it's how people are feeling about this economy. Do you buy that?
Oh, absolutely. And I think part of the confusion here is that, you know, just as we heard in the piece that you ran, different parts of the economy are experiencing, you know, the last 6 months really differently. Mm-hmm. If you're somewhere in the goods sector, you're probably feeling like we're in an outright recession. But if you're in the services sector, you probably feel like things are going like gangbusters. So those two different people might be experiencing what feels like completely different economies.
Is it possible that with the labor market as strong as it is, and with, you know, as Chair Powell says all the time, those two job openings for every one person looking, is it possible that a slowdown, right, growth below potential, would be okay in some degree?
So here's the ideal scenario, because, you know, let's step back and remember that that last year GDP grew like 5.5%.
Right, right.
Consumer spending grew 6.9%. Like we were well outside our sustainable levels for all sorts of reasons. And so the economy really has been on track to slow and needs to slow. The ideal outcome is that we see inflation at the same time that the economy is slowing, inflation come down to more acceptable levels. If that happens, we will get the hoped for soft landing.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Powell talked about the soft landing yesterday, and he said the path increasingly relies on things that are outside the Fed's control.
Well, okay, so what does a hard landing look like? So the bad outcome would be if the economy slows, but inflation still hangs up really high. Right. And that could be for two reasons. One is inflation expectations. And that is a little bit in the Fed's control. I mean, let's hope it's in the Fed's control. They would need to do more to bring down inflation expectations. Mm-hmm. The other thing could be supply shocks, that we keep getting hit with higher and higher energy prices, higher and higher food prices. That may well be what he had in mind when he said things outside of the Fed's control. But the Fed still has to take the world that it's given.
Yeah.
And what it might be learning from those supply shocks is that the landing spot that the Fed is trying to get the economy back to is just lower. It's just a lower landing spot. We have less potential. We have less wealth. We have a somewhat worse future ahead of us. And that's bad news. But, you know, that might be what we're learning with all the news about energy and food prices and such.
Right. Let me ask you about expectations real quick. We got like half a minute, 45 seconds. How much of the agita that we're seeing about inflation, while completely justified, right? 9.1% year on year is a lot. How much of that is because there are generations of people in this country who have never experienced inflation like this and so are freaked out a little bit?
Well, surely that is part of it. You know, there are people who probably would yawn at 9% inflation, but do remember that there are some goods and services that have actually seen much higher inflation. So what we've seen in energy prices and food prices is actually much, much higher.
All right. Last thing, and I lied. I'm going to take another 30 seconds. Are we, and by we, I mean those of us who cover business and financial journalism and economic journalism, are we doing it wrong by fixating on this, by being so attentive to, ooh, are we or aren't we?
Oh, I mean, whether or not we're in a recession, no, that is not, it's not an incredibly interesting question at this moment, because the economy for the typical person is not terribly different if we grow modestly or shrink modestly. That masks huge variations in how people are experiencing things, what labor market they're feeling. So, you know, I get it, but no, it's more important what's happening to the labor market.
All right. Fair enough. Wendy Edelberg at Brookings, also the Hamilton Project. Wendy, thanks a lot. Good to talk to you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Wall Street today, you know, traders are feeling pretty good, as they, you know, have been lately. Details, numbers, you know the drill. In legislative updates about this economy, the House passed the CHIPS bill today, $52 billion specifically for semiconductor companies, billions more for other tech. Also in the congressional sausage maker is a package that's gotten West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin's approval. Healthcare is in it, tax code changes, and a whole lot of money for climate change. If it passes as is, almost $370 billion in energy and climate change programs, tax incentives for wind and solar, for battery production and clean manufacturing, and for anyone making $150,000 or less, incentives to buy a new or used electric vehicle. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on that one.
Transportation is currently the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S.
So it's really important to help everyday Americans get into cheaper and cleaner electric vehicles.
Leah Stokes at UC Santa Barbara says the new tax credits in this bill would go a long way towards doing that. People who qualify could get a $7,500 tax credit on a new clean car or a $4,000 credit on a used one.
It's going to make EVs probably cheaper than a new gas-powered car. EVs are already pretty much cost competitive with gas cars. So with this tax credit, it's going to make it even more affordable.
Right now, though, it can be hard to find an EV to buy, says Adi Tomer at the Brookings Institution.
There's just not enough of the models, both on production lines, but also available on the lots.
Car companies are still transitioning to making EVs, and supply chain issues are making production a lot slower. But Tamara says the credits and other funding in this new bill, plus all the money for electric vehicles that already passed in the infrastructure package, should help with that supply problem.
We are making significant investments on the production side for EVs. So if we use the incentives to actually increase demand for them, we have a real chance to get more of these cleaner electric vehicles on the road.
And as the number of EVs on the road goes up, the need for charging stations does too. Gil Tal at the Electric Vehicle Research Center at UC Davis says these days more chargers are popping up all the time.
There is a lot of federal money, state money, private money that go into the charging infrastructure, and it's changing fast.
The Department of Energy says there are more than 49,000 charging stations around the country. Plus, Tal says a lot of people can just plug in to any old outlet at home. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Technology can be amazing. It can also be completely frustrating, even when it comes to something as basic as ordering and paying for something we want to buy. We want to give our money to somebody, and sometimes technology makes it harder. The operative acronym here for our purposes is POS, Point of Sale Systems, the technology that lets us use QR codes instead of menus or swipe or tap our credit cards at the point of sale, right? POS systems got really popular at the beginning of the pandemic. Think how contactless everything had to be. But as Marketplace's Justin Ho reminds us, new technology sometimes doesn't work so well.
A couple weeks ago, Marisa Johnson was working at a market and cafe near San Diego called Alfresco. Early in her shift, she went to ring up some customers with the market's point of sale system, Square.
And it just went completely black.
Johnson tried restarting the machine. She unplugged it, tried a different outlet, all while the customers were standing there waiting to buy some fancy olive oil, cocktail mixers, and a throw blanket.
And I see all these items, and in my head, I'm doing the math. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is a huge purchase. I can't let this go. So, you know, just trying to figure out ways to make this sale happen.
A big sale like that is a big deal for Alfresco. Jenny Nizgoda is the owner.
Being a small business in, you know, kind of unique times, it's like if we have a, you know, a couple $100 sale coming through, we need that right now.
To make matters worse, Nizgoda's employee couldn't even reach her when the system was down because she was out of town visiting family in Texas.
It's just like the worst thing that can happen when you decide to step away for your first vacation in 5 years.
While the system was down, Johnson made a quick decision. She asked the customers to pay using the app Venmo instead. It worked throughout the rest of her shift. And even though it was a pretty stressful day,
you just have to just be kind and charming and funny and make light of it and let them think that this is funny and cute and they're actually having a good experience when it's an inconvenience.
Square shipped a replacement part a few days later. Before these kinds of payment systems came along, businesses used separate devices to handle credit card payments and customer orders. Lisa Ellis is senior equity analyst at MoffittNathanson. She says newer point-of-sale systems like Square do it all.
That includes that hardware, the card reader, the business software, and the payment processing all in one bundle.
But that means when a point-of-sale system goes down, it can be a disaster for a business.
At the end of the day, you can't really control your own fate.
Steve Chu is co-owner of a sandwich restaurant in Baltimore called Ekibent.
Just because there's so many different external factors that go into running a POS system smoothly.
On a busy weekend about a month ago, his point-of-sale system, called Toast, had a service outage, and there wasn't really much he could do about it.
You could call customer service, but in this instance, it was like, we know there's an outage, like, give us some time and we'll fix it.
Toast offers an offline mode that allows businesses to keep taking payments during service disruptions. But Chu says that wouldn't have done much for him, because customers still wouldn't have been able to order online. He says the outage likely cost him hundreds of orders, which could have brought in thousands of dollars.
We had no business for like 4 hours. It really like shafted us.
Throughout the pandemic, point-of-sale systems have had to add a lot of additional features. Lisa Ellis with MoffittNathanson says that includes things like contactless payments, QR code ordering, curbside pickup.
The minute you had the pandemic, it was essential that you were able to do curbside pickup, right? And so some of these products maybe rolled out features out of necessity very, very quickly.
Ellis says these POS systems handle about a quarter of customer transactions for small businesses. She says the dollar volume they handle has been growing by 30% every year. As a result,
it wouldn't surprise me that there are some growing pains from a customer support and servicing perspective because they were shipping product as fast as they could, right, to try to meet demand.
POS company Toast cut Steve Chu a check to reimburse him for the lost business during the service outage. Square says it continues to invest in the resiliency of its systems and offers a warranty on equipment. That said, Steve Chu is in the market for a new point-of-sale system, and so is Jenny Nizgoda. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Coming up,
hope of higher future wealth and better quality of life.
Sounds pretty good to me, right? First, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 332 today, 1%, 32,529. The NASDAQ increased 130 points, also 1%, 12,162. The S&P 500 rose 48 points, about 1.2%, 4,072 there. Some seat shuffling in the airline industry with the announcement that JetBlue has a deal to take over Spirit Airlines for $3.8 billion. That comes after Spirit failed to land a merger with Frontier. Anyway, JetBlue down 0.3% today, Spirit up 5.5%. Bond prices up, yield on the 10-year T-note fell 2.67%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We know, because we keep track of this stuff, that lots of people have left their jobs in the past year. 47 million of us in 2021. So says something called JOLTS. That's the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey, the next update of which we get on Tuesday. What the raw data doesn't tell us, though, is what happens after those people quit. So enter now a study out today from the Pew Research Center that finds the majority of workers in this economy who switched jobs between April 2021 and this past March, not just a majority, by the way, but 60% of job switchers saw an increase in real earnings. That is, they made more money in their new jobs even when adjusted for inflation. Of those who stayed where they were, less than half got a pay raise. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more on how money is a powerful motivator, though to be clear, not the only one.
Anthony Klotz is a professor of management at University College London and actually coined the term the Great Resignation.
Obviously, I didn't know it was going to go viral and be used as much as it was.
Klotz says there are lots of reasons people move from job to job, but money is a highly visible one.
One thing that we can often see in that next job is that it pays more. So we may not know whether we'll like our next boss or our coworkers, but usually we can figure out the pay pretty easily.
Pew's new study finds that 60% of workers who did switch jobs between April 2021 and this past March earned more money in their new roles, even when adjusted for inflation. For people who stayed with the same employer, fewer than half saw that increase. Rakesh Kochur is one of the authors of the report.
So people staying put they experienced a loss in real earnings.
And the less money a job pays, the bigger a difference it makes to the worker. Josh Burson is an industry analyst who studies human resources. He says there's a kind of hierarchy of work needs.
At the bottom is things like pay and benefits and healthcare. And once you get enough pay to keep you happy, then you don't constantly search for a new job to make more money.
Burson says people unhappy in their current jobs should tell their employers what they want, money or otherwise. Still, it doesn't always work. Across the Atlantic, Anthony Klotz is part of the Great Resignation himself. Earlier this year, he moved from Texas A&M to his new position in the UK.
A lot of my move had to do with the pull of London.
Klotz says Texas A&M was a great boss, and his case shows sometimes employers lose workers to factors beyond their control. In Baltimore, though, also dreaming of London someday, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
The big economic news of the day today is, of course, gross domestic product and its fluctuations. But we happened upon some research the other day that caught our attention. Research suggesting that you might be able to blame the news itself, news of technology in particular, for a measurable chunk of those fluctuations. Christoph Gortz is a professor of macroeconomics at the University of Birmingham, one of the authors of that research in question.
Sure. So on an almost daily basis, we read and learn about imminent technological changes that give us hope of higher future wealth and better quality of life. But we do not have to wait for these new technologies to become actually available for them to start affecting our lives. So should I give you a simple example?
I was just going to say an example would be helpful because I've got an objection, I think. But like, give me your example and then we'll go from there.
Consider this scenario. Upon news of a substantial future pay rise, one may want to celebrate this success with a nice meal at a restaurant, mm-hmm. or the purchase of that really long-wanted but far too expensive racing bike. And typically, one would not want to wait for the higher pay to actually show up in the bank account, but one would want to celebrate and consume already in anticipation of that pay rise. So if you project this simple example onto the whole economy, something very similar happens.
Okay. Yes to all of that, and Lord knows I myself have fallen victim to the circumstances where that happens. But not all technological advances that affect the workplace are necessarily positive for one's paycheck or one's mood or one's happiness at work, right?
Indeed, but it's not only about the consumers; it's also about entrepreneurs, producers, etc. New technologies mean business opportunities. It means higher profits potentially. And in that way, it means something positive for the whole economy.
Can you quantify how much broad-based economic gain we see because of news of future technological advancements?
So it's not necessarily about the gain.
Okay.
Fluctuation is the business cycle, the booms and recessions that we see. About 50% of the business cycle fluctuations are explained by news about future technologies, because it's not always that this positive news would drive growth upwards. It can also be that they are super positive news and actually right. People at some point realize, well, our assumption wasn't correct. We are not as wealthy as we assumed. And then we may fall into a recession. And actually, this is what people believe has happened around the 2001 dot-com boom and the burst of that bubble.
Is it, how to phrase this? One of the things that was on people's minds a number of years ago, not so much anymore, but a number of years ago, is that robots are going to take all our jobs. The technology is going to come in and we're not going to need, I don't know, 3 million truck drivers in the American economy because we're going to have self-driving trucks. Would that temper the optimism of which you speak, do you think?
Well, it's a good question, because it depends on the composition of the labor force, right? And on the ability for maybe these truck drivers to retrain to do other jobs. So this will be costly, definitely for some, and very painful for some individuals, but the economy will have higher profitability, more business opportunities from that, and as a whole, the country will be wealthier.
Professor Christoph Gartz is at the University of Birmingham. He teaches macroeconomics there. Professor, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Many thanks. It was a pleasure.
This final note on the way out today. So look, you might as well just go ahead and cancel Halloween, all right? Hershey said this morning that supply chain disruptions and the Russian invasion of Ukraine are leading to shortages of cocoa and edible oils and a bunch of other ingredients. And so the company is not going to be able to meet Halloween demand. Shed no tears for the candy maker, though. Higher prices mean it's going to meet its sales targets just fine. All right, we got to go. Here is your moment of economic context. If you are tracking organized labor, here's one for you. Workers at a Trader Joe's in Hadley, Massachusetts have voted to unionize. That's a first for that chain. Amir Bibawi and John Buckley, Eve Epstein and John Gordon, Rick Carr and Diantha Parker, Amanda Petra and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.